Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, trying to turn the page after a bad week and slipping poll numbers, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump gave a big economic speech in Detroit, focusing on lower taxes, less regulation, energy, trade. Hillary Clinton's talking about economics this week, too. This hour, On Point, Trump and Clinton on the economy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Who's speaking to you on the American economy, on positioning this country for real shared success? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's Donald Trump yesterday in Detroit, Michigan, detailing in part his economic plan to, he said, open a new chapter in American prosperity.
When we reform our tax, trade, energy, and regulatory policies, we will open a new chapter in American prosperity, which is so desperately needed. We need a new chapter. We can use this new wealth to rebuild our military, which is desperately needed, and our infrastructure.
We need a new chapter. Let's dive in and see what Trump's economics might mean. Stack them up against Hillary Clinton's a little bit. With us from Washington today is Jim Tankersley, economic policy reporter for The Washington Post. Jim, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
Also with us, Melanie Trotman, Wall Street Journal reporter covering labor, economics, workplace trends. Melanie, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Neil Irwin is here, senior economic correspondent for The New York Times, writes for the Times analysis blog The Upshot, wrote this weekend about the low-growth world everyone's facing right now, essentially. He's the author of The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Neil Irwin, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
The conclusion of your big piece over the weekend, Neil, before Donald Trump's speech, was that, you know, we don't – you say – what we do know is that if something doesn't change from recent trends, the 21st century will be a gloomy one in economic terms. Did you hear in Donald Trump's Detroit speech yesterday an effective turn away from that low growth scenario that now sits in front of us?
Well, I think whether you believe Donald Trump has an answer for this period of low GDP growth, low economic growth we've had over the last 15 years or so, it kind of depends on whether you buy his basic ideology, his basic diagnosis of what has gone wrong. He is resting his thesis on the idea that that this low growth period has been caused by too many trade deals that are disadvantageous for American workers, on excessive regulation that has made businesses unable to adapt and been anti-business and anti-growth, and that the tax code has been in need of some real pruning and lower taxes to get growth going. You know, you could argue that we've tried different experience of that, and that the evidence is not compelling. But that's his argument, and there's certainly an audience for it.
Hillary Clinton not buying it. Of course, she's running against him. Here she was in St. Petersburg, Florida, yesterday, going straight at the plan. Same old, same old, she said.
They are just playing the same old siren song. And why they haven't learned, we are not interested in economic plans that only help the top 1%. It's time we helped everybody else in America get ahead and stay ahead.
Jim Tankersley, do you see Donald Trump going to a traditional Republican playbook, a Reagan Republican playbook, a George W. Bush playbook, or something entirely new here?
I think Trump is new. And he's new in the fusion he brings to his policies. And I think it's best to think of it as the following. He is a bit more conservative on economic issues than Reagan or Bush when it comes to taxes. He has
meaning what, Jim?
He has a bigger tax cut plan. He would take tax rates lower than they were under George W. Bush. under his plan. And his corporate rate cut would be one of the steepest – it's one of the steepest proposals out there.
From 35% down to 15%.
Down to 15% for all businesses, not just ones listed as corporations. So that's a big tax cut. And on this, he is very traditional Republican, and he's very traditional Republican on his desire to freeze regulations and roll back some other ones. Where he is not traditionally Republican, the sort of the hybrid that he brings is like Neil mentioned, these trade deals. He spends so much time talking about renegotiating the terms of trade. He has explicitly threatened tariffs on China and other U.S. trading partners, which he's the most outspoken proponent of that among Republicans since Herbert Hoover. And then you have on top of that a very liberal infrastructure plan and a big, big spending infrastructure plan that he has indicated, if possible. We haven't seen the details yet, but he has mentioned several times that he wants to do a big infrastructure spending plan. All of which adds up probably, unless there are some huge spending cuts out there we haven't seen yet, to his desire to swell the budget deficit and add on to the national debt.
Melanie, he pitched this yesterday in Detroit to working Americans, and that's the way he framed it. Does the plan actually go to their interest, to their bottom line?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I write about labor, and that includes labor unions. And as you likely know, the unions are not fans of Donald Trump at all. They're trying to paint him as an anti-worker candidate. Now, he did pitch a child care plan. I mean, there are more details to come, but he said that he was going to make it tax deductible. And, child care is a big issue right now. Costs are rising at nearly twice the rate of inflation since the end of the recession. The criticism of his, at least initial plan announced yesterday, is that it would largely benefit higher income people. And so there's a question of whether or not it will really even get at the core of child care costs and rising child care costs for middle income or lower income families.
Because many of them are not even wouldn't be taking deductions. They don't make enough to benefit from what he's proposing, though if you were upper middle or wealthy, you could pay the nanny with it.
Exactly. Many low-wage workers don't pay federal taxes.
Melanie, why are unions not fired up by Donald Trump if he's going to fire up the economy and he says make it work for the little guy?
Yeah. Well, he has taken positions on things that unions care a lot about that haven't been in their favor. He has said that he likes right-to-work laws. Right-to-work laws, from unions' point of view, are terrible. They allow people to join unions but not pay certain dues or fees. And that hurts the unions economically. It hurts their political power. And they're fighting against right-to-work laws. So they don't want that. Trump, he also doesn't really talk much about collective bargaining. Hillary Clinton has talked up collective bargaining and said she's going to fight for that. And then Trump he's had an evolution on wages. But one thing he has said back in November during a political debate, he said that wages are too high. He has since sort of changed his position on that, but the unions are being relentless in focusing on that and saying that it's a sign that he really doesn't think people should be paid more for their work.
Trump yesterday saying he wants across-the-board income tax reductions, but especially talking of the benefits for middle-class Americans. Here he was.
I am proposing an across-the-board income tax reduction, especially for middle-income Americans. This will lead to millions of new and really good-paying jobs. The rich will pay their fair share, but no one will pay so much that it destroys jobs or undermines our ability as a nation to compete.
Neil Irwin, what do you see on the tax front here, and who would benefit from what? He wants to take us down to just three tax brackets, and they would all be lower than they all are now. Who really comes out ahead there?
So what Trump has done, he's kind of tossed aside his earlier tax plan and embraced a version of what House Republicans proposed earlier this year. So that does put him more in line with congressional majority of his party. But what that policy does, it is true that it lowers taxes on everyone in the House Republican proposal. But the benefits are much, much larger for the very wealthiest Americans who see their top marginal tax rate go from almost 40% to 33%. And so the analysis that the Tax Foundation has done shows that the gain in after-tax income for the top 1% of earners is about 5.3%. For the middle class, it's 0.2%. So much stronger after-tax gains of these tax plans for the very wealthy. I'll add that Jim kind of alluded to this briefly. He also advocates this dramatic cut in the business tax and wants that to apply to all business income, which means that if you're an affluent person, a rich person mm-hmm. who's clever enough, you have good tax advisors who can turn your regular income into business income, you can find ways to get an actual 15% tax rate instead of the current 40%. So add those two things together, and this is a very favorable package for affluent Americans.
And what about the economy overall? I mean, people say, well, maybe it would jumpstart other things that would end up helping those who are lower middle income. I mean, George Bush, as you remind us today, had big tax cuts pushed through Congress in 2001, 2003, promised strong growth on the back of those. That never materialized. Is there some reason to think that that would be different here, Neil?
I mean, this is the core of the ideological argument that's been at the core of U.S. politics for more than 30 years.
After 30 years, can't we take it out of ideology and look at the evidence? Is there not an answer yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is pretty good evidence. The middle of this decade, you know, this period I mentioned earlier of very low growth really started in about 2000, 2001. Now, that's not all George W. Bush's fault, of course, but it is the case that we had these considerable tax cuts, especially on investment income, especially on upper income brackets in 2001 and 2003. And the expansion in the mid-2000s and then through the crisis was not terribly impressive.
So, Jim, does that leave a Republican, I mean, he's got all kinds of problems still. 50 security experts, Republicans bailing on him today saying not fit to be president. We've got Senator Collins, Republican of Maine, saying she's not going to vote for him. What about Republican economists? He goes back to familiar themes, but he also says tear up trade deals. Are they lining up with him, Jim, or not?
So officially, he does not have very many of the what you would consider establishment Republican economists behind him. He basically has one, Steve Moore, who was the chief economist from the Clifford Growth, who was a tax expert and who was a big-time advocate of what they call pro-growth tax theory, which is what Neil just talked about. Cutting taxes mm-hmm. will unleash much faster growth, which will help everybody. What Mr. Trump does not have is anyone who served in a senior capacity for a previous Republican administration or anyone who was a lead economic advisor for a previous Republican nominee. And that is basically historically unprecedented among nominees.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Donald Trump's economic plan rollout yesterday, or fresh rollout, looking to hit a restart button after a rough week last week. You might have been listening. He had a lot to say in Detroit, a lot of interruptions there, too. Sort of maybe more than a dozen times protesters speaking up. Here's just one example as he talked about low home ownership.
Home ownership is at its lowest rate in 51 years.
Trump kept his cool yesterday. It happened again and again, though, but he plowed right on. Here he was talking about regulation and small business.
You cannot ever start a small business under the tremendous regulatory burden that you have today in our country. I'm going to end it. I am going to cut regulations massively. Massively.
Cut those regulations. Of course, Hillary Clinton talking about the economy as well. She's going to talk more about it on Thursday. But here she was at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia going at those at the top of the economic ladder.
Wall Street, corporations, and the super rich are going to start paying their fair share of taxes. This is not because we resent success, but when more than 90% of the gains have gone to the top 1%, that's where the money is.
Hillary Clinton talking big on going where the money is. Neil Irwin is with us today, senior economic correspondent for the New York Times. Melanie Trotman's here from the Wall Street Journal, covers labor economics, workplace trends there. Jim Tankersley, economic policy reporter for the Washington Post. You can join us as well. Do you see tax cuts, less regulation, and tearing up trade deals as the way to go? Who would Trump be good for? And what about Hillary Clinton? How do you understand her economic vision for this country? Let's get callers right in here. John in Buffalo, New York. John, you're on the air. What did you hear?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I listened to Trump's speech yesterday, and it did sound like the old Republican playbook with less taxes and less regulation, which was unsettling, although it was nice to hear him talk about tearing up the trade deals, which I think free trade has been really bad for working class Americans. But I think my main point is that on the left, the Democrats have basically been snakes in the grass. When I hear Clinton saying that we're going to have the super rich and the 1% start paying their fair share, I'm hearing populist language being co-opted, where I can't really trust the Democrats to do that, because even though we had a recovery under Obama's years, 95% of that recovery went to the top 1%. I don't think that they're beholden to anybody but the 1%, and the working class only has one real choice when it comes to economics, and that's Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party.
We've got it, Johnny, and I appreciate your call. We're talking this week to Gary Johnson, the Libertarian. We'll be talking with Jill Stein of the Green Party as well. Melanie Trautman, what about this criticism that, you know, Hillary Clinton talking a big game now after Bernie Sanders, after Trump has emerged here, and maybe over time, but the facts do speak for themselves in a way as to where the wealth and income have concentrated through Republican and Democratic administrations. How should American voters look at that as they weigh these proposals?
Yeah, well, Bernie Sanders certainly did move Hillary Clinton more to the left. I watched it happen. We all watched it happen on issues like trade and on minimum wage. At first, I think people on the left, labor unions, other progressive groups were skeptical of her. She came out late against the TPP. And on minimum wage, she appeared to be supporting a $15 minimum wage, but really she supports a $12 minimum wage and says that states and cities can go higher. You know, I think that Hillary has been pushed into a corner, and I think she's as good as it gets, from at least from the point of view of labor unions, again, which I write about a lot and cover, and their members, because she has said that she'll be a champion for them and for working people in the White House. Again, she said she'll fight for collective bargaining to preserve it. And Trump isn't saying some of those things. And so I think that they're looking to that as the best they've got in terms of trying to preserve the benefits that they have and some of the rights that they have that they think help not only labor unions, but low-income workers in America overall.
I mean, Trump was making a bigger critique, though, yesterday. He was laying everything on what he called Hillary Clinton's failed economic agenda, speaking in Detroit and saying, and of course, Detroit has a lot of problems, and saying that this city is a living, breathing example of her failed economic agenda. Let's listen for a second.
She supports the high taxes and radical regulation that force jobs out of your community. And the crime policies have made you far, far less safe. And the immigration policies that have strained local budgets and the trade deals like NAFTA, signed by her husband, that have shipped your jobs to Mexico and other countries.
There, Donald Trump in Detroit yesterday. Neil Irwin, you know, on many fronts, Donald Trump talks sort of turning over the tables. And this sounded like that to me again. Like, we're going to do something completely different here. I mean, the trade part, the taxes may be something familiar from Republican trade book. The trade part is something new, very anti-immigrant. I mean, even went into against refugees yesterday, I think, for a little while there. But do you see something in his of merit in his critique of Hillary Clinton as, you know, having a failed agenda that you can pin Detroit on? And him as doing something radically different here, or is this another one of these, oh my God, Donald, where are you going, that, that doesn't hold together things?
Look, there's a lot of reasons Detroit is in bad shape, and you know, the decline of the U.S. auto industry is a long story. But one thing to keep in mind, there's also a pretty booming auto industry in several southern states with international companies, you know, Nissan, Toyota, BMW, Honda, building plants that are operating in the southern states. So the decline of Detroit isn't just about trade. It isn't just about globalization. It isn't just about regulation. It's you know, some problems unique to those U.S. automakers. Again, Detroit has a lot of problems. I don't want to suggest it's just one thing. You know, I think the question is, do you believe that this is a system that of globalization, global trade, that creates real benefits, or is this something that should be thrown out? And I think Trump is, you know, we don't know exactly how he would govern and exactly how aggressive he would be in practice. But if you take his rhetoric at face value, he's willing to risk a trade war. He's willing to risk really breaking down these deep interconnections that we have with U.S., with Canada, with Mexico, with Canada, with China, with Asia, in hopes of negotiating a better deal and risking, you know, he's threatened to drop out of the World Trade Organization. He's threatened huge tariffs on Chinese goods. Mm-hmm. You know, that could be very disruptive. And the question is breaking up this kind of system of globalization and trade that we've been living with for the last 30 years, is that a risk worth taking?
Jim, we don't want to be prisoners of the status quo here. And a lot of Americans have expressed frustration in their votes for Donald Trump in primaries. How do you assess this kind of promise to really mix things up, even risk perhaps a trade war? Of course, his critics say he risks recession and you know, everything kind of falling to pieces. How do you do a sober analysis? Because this is important stuff. I mean, we're talking about potentially a big attack on a whole system. Some people are frustrated with it and may want that attack. But how do you assess the viability, the merit, the likely outcome of a Trump approach?
Well, first off, I would note that the Trump team, you know, his advisors, what he himself argues, they say that there's not going to be a trade war, that what would happen is, faced with a strong leader in the White House who is making these threats against them, other countries would back down, renegotiate terms of trade, and America would win, you know, and growth would improve. I think that a lot of economists are skeptical of that idea, but that I think it's important to make the say what that's mm-hmm. what the Trump argument is.
He's going to be so darned impressive at the negotiating table that they'll fold.
Right, exactly. And I think that really speaks to the frustrations of a particular slice of the electorate who feels like no one has looked out for their interests for so long, that no one has stood up and said, we need to make things better for the little guy. And to your point about frustration, you know, I write about the middle class. I've written about the middle class for a long time. Mm-hmm. This is not new. This is not like something Donald Trump discovered overnight and is the first to tap into. He's just tapped into it in a way that we haven't seen before, and he's unified particular parts of the electorate we haven't seen before. And I think we would be wrong to think that anger and frustration would dissipate either if he wins and is unable to achieve the policy proposals that he has pushed for or the policy outcomes that he wants, or it would dissipate if he loses. I mean, I think
he's calling it out in a new way here, Jim.
He's
made a systemic critique, even if it's kind of a hodgepodge. In a way that nobody sort of inside the traditional political parties has done, certainly not Trump style.
Because it's so cross-ideological, I guess is the way to put it, because it borrows from both liberal ideas and conservative ideas to make this bigger point that essentially the rest of the world is winning at your expense, you being the blue-collar American worker. And there's a lot of evidence that that's not how trade works, that's not how immigration works, that there are mutual benefits that can come from those, you know, from people moving across borders and from goods moving across borders. However, there's also a lot of frustration correctly felt among a lot of workers that the terms of globalization have not favored the middle class in America. And so I think having watched voters in states like Ohio, where I used to work, mm-hmm. and then along the presidential campaign trail the last couple of cycles, hear for so long from politicians, this time we're going to make it better for you. I can see their frustration because no one ever delivers that, and they feel their income stagnating and they don't see the opportunities that they want to have. And that is where Trump is succeeding, because they are so frustrated they are willing to take a flyer on something completely different.
Let's go to Dawsonville, Georgia. Amanda is calling. Hi, Amanda. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I think Jim said most of what I was going to say. I disagree with the critics of Donald Trump's plan. I disagree with Senator Collins for saying that he's not qualified. I disagree with Hillary Clinton for saying it's the same old. As Jim was saying, he's mixing several economic plans. And he obviously, the economic plans have not worked in the last 15 years. Our Republican Congress has not followed through on their economic plans for growth. And the word threat of that you're that people are saying Donald Trump is threatening.
Risky Trump,
yeah. I don't know. Yeah, threat's kind of a strong word because until he gets into office, we don't really know what he's going to do. I do know that he's a businessman. He is surrounded by good advisors, although they're not from the establishment.
Amanda, we've got it. I mean, I take your point, and a lot of people want something different. Is it too much to talk about risk? I don't know. I do know you've got these 50 Republicans signing this big letter today saying that he lacks the character, values, and experience to be president, that he would put at risk our country's national security and well-being. But, Melanie, you hear again right there a Trump supporter saying, give me a break. The way we've done it hasn't worked, and I want something different. I mean, they can say, and they did write in this letter, he'd be the most reckless president in American history, but then there's a demand for do something different here.
That's right. And to elaborate on what Jim said a few minutes ago, Trump's tough talk on trade, it is resonating with a pocket of union members. I've talked to some of them. My colleagues have met some of them in Pennsylvania at manufacturing plants. They have seen people lose their jobs. In the past, they themselves have lost their jobs because of trade deals. There's resentment. There is some resentment toward Hillary Clinton, NAFTA. I mean, she didn't vote on NAFTA. She wasn't in a position to vote, but she did say that she favored it.
It was Bill Clinton's baby, obviously.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, that message is, I think, having an impact. And that is, that's a mixing, right? Because usually, the Republican who's running, is taking a more traditionally GOP position on trade. I also think Trump's message on regulation. I mean, I think he's getting, the attention of the small business owner. Many small business owners aren't Republicans. There are Democrats who I've talked to who are torn because they feel that there is too much regulation. On the labor front, I mean, they say that there have been too many rules that have come out of the Obama administration, and it's time to ease it. They're saying that the impact has been negative for them and for workers and for the economy. And Trump saying he's going to put a moratorium on this and he's going to roll back regs. I think that that message is drawing in small business owners across the country and not just Republicans.
I want to look at regulations, but let's stick with trade for a second, Neil. I mean, what is real here? Donald Trump talks about the U.S. being ripped off right, left, and center globally. Does that add up? And when he talks about remaking this, you know, this mixing of plans and sort of blowing up the trade agreements is a big part of that. Is that for real, or is that just talk? Could that actually be done, or is that just blowing smoke?
He did in this speech lay out some of the specific things he would do. He's done that before, labeling China a currency manipulator, renegotiating NAFTA, abandoning the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So those are concrete things he could do. I think the question is, one thing that's frustrating if you kind of write about economics is there's a great emphasis on what trade has done and globalization has done in terms of middle class incomes and jobs in the U.S. But, there are a lot of forces impacting what's going on at any given moment. And so we've also had this era of technological change and automation. We've also had this era in which around the world we've seen declining middle class incomes for a lot of reasons. And so to disentangle those things and understand how much of that is really driven by trade and globalization and how much of that is just really forces beyond anybody's control is really difficult. But the answer to your question is if Donald Trump is the president and he's serious about what he says, then yes, he can be, do a lot to disrupt, U.S. trade relationships.
But just disrupting trade relationships doesn't necessarily mean a better economy. I mean, it could go the other way. And Americans are making an assessment here about whether they want him to roll in there, Jim, and, start blazing away. Now, you talked about how he asserts that at the negotiating table he could just cut a better deal, but it gets down to how realistic that is. You got countervailing interests here. China's a serious player, too. So are many others. They have their own interests to defend here. We're putting our national economy on the line. Is there realistic hope of him bringing home some great, victory here on the trade front that would substantially change things for working Americans, make Detroit a manufacturing center again?
So, I mean, I think it's impossible to predict the future, but you can make good evidence-based guesses with research. And the economists I've talked to say that it's more likely than not that if we start threatening tariffs on other countries, both they will retaliate with tariffs, and if you're putting a tariff on, say, China, production might move more readily to Vietnam or Pakistan or somewhere else like that than it would move back to the United States. You would need a very strong signal to tell employers, no, you should shut down all of your overseas manufacturing and reopen it here in the United States.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, talking this hour about Donald Trump's economic policy rollout on its own terms and some of how it compares to what Hillary Clinton has in mind. Neil Irwin is with us, senior economic correspondent for the New York Times. Melanie Trotman's here from the Wall Street Journal, looks at labor and the workplace. Jim Tankersley covers economic policy for the Washington Post. You can join us as well. Did you listen to Mr. Trump? How do you see a Trump economy versus a Clinton economy, a Trump approach versus a Clinton approach? Here was Trump talking on trade yesterday in Detroit.
It includes strong protections against currency manipulation. Big problem. Tariffs against any countries that cheat by unfairly subsidizing their goods. And it includes a total renegotiation of NAFTA, which is a disaster for our country.
And Hillary Clinton, here she was in June at a rally with Democratic Congressman James Costa, talking about her $275 billion five-year infrastructure plan.
We need to invest more in infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our ports, our airports, our water systems. Congressman Costa and I were just talking. We are living off the investments and the hard work of our parents and our grandparents.
Trump talking trade, Hillary Clinton there talking infrastructure. Jim, what about on the infrastructure front? Who's got a bigger bump on the boards, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, and who could pay for it?
Well, Hillary Clinton has actually put out a plan with some details to it. Donald Trump has said he is going to. And Donald Trump has said his plan will be twice as big as Hillary Clinton's plan, which has, I believe, that Secretary Clinton's plan is up to like $275 mm-hmm. billion. Dollars. Mm-hmm. So that would be a large, very large plan for Mr. Trump, although not as large as the one Bernie Sanders proposed in the Democratic primaries. He has not put out any pay-fors, really, for any of his plans.
Any pay-fors? Explanations for how he would cover the cost, you mean?
Yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm. I've been in Wonk
right.
too many weeks, I guess.
All right.
Yes. He has not described how he would raise the revenues to fund these proposals. Secretary Clinton has talked about raising taxes on the rich and in a way to get more money. There are some questions about whether her books entirely balance out. But for the most part, she is spelling out ways she would pay for her plans. And back to the very beginning when you were talking with Neil about a low-growth world, mm-hmm. you know, one thing that liberal economists very much believe is that if the government borrowed more money and spent it on infrastructure right now, it would be a particularly high return on that in terms of new economic growth. And so on this front, both Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton are talking about something that has, in liberal economists' views, real potential to kickstart that level of growth upwards.
Neil, is it credible to you then that Hillary Clinton pays as she goes for her proposals? Donald Trump, at one time, they were talking about a $10 trillion in new red ink under his plans. Now, after yesterday, I see people talking maybe $2 or $3 trillion. Optimists saying not much. What about the red ink on the backside of all this talk?
Yeah, there's fairly straightforward, as Jim described. Secretary Clinton has a number of plans, but she also has tax increases, especially on the wealthy, that would pay for those plans. Donald Trump has a bunch of tax cuts, which would reduce revenue, and then talks about infrastructure, talks about things that would that would involve more spending. He talks about strengthening the military more. That means one of two things. It means either vast cuts in the rest of the federal budget, the entire social welfare spending, who knows what else, or it implies running much larger budget deficits. Now, you could argue maybe right now the U.S. should be running larger budget deficits. Interest rates are so low. But that's the simple fact. You know, for 8 years, Republicans have been talking a lot about debt and deficits and complaining about the Obama-era deficits. If you take, Trump doesn't really put out really detailed footnoted policy plans. But if you just read between the lines, it would seem to suggest he's going to radically increase the deficit.
I mean, Melanie, there's a kind of whiplash here where Obama did spend on infrastructure, wanted to spend more, ran into all kinds of resistance from Republicans on exactly this deficit-fighting front. And now their own the party gets taken over by Captain Trump, and maybe he plunges in and tries to do exactly in some part what Obama wanted to do. Would a Republican Congress go along with a President Trump if he wanted to roll out the red ink?
You know, infrastructure is one area that traditionally has been where there's bipartisan, agreement. It's something that you would have thought would have been done, I think, over the past 8 years. It hasn't happened.
It certainly has not been bipartisan agreement in for those 8 years. I mean, they fought tooth and nail. And all they talked was deficits and how terribly important it was to stop them now.
Right. I think a President Trump would have a better chance of getting Republican support on infrastructure.
Jose in Marietta, Georgia. Jose, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. All of Donald Trump's life, he has spent pitching these grandiose projects to bankers and financiers that's going to make everybody rich and, it's going to be the best and the biggest and whatever. And, when these projects go south, he bails out with a convenient bankruptcy, goes on to his next grandiose project. And on The Apprentice, he was the big enchilada and obviously the star of the show and, he was in power and all that stuff. But in reality, that reality show, he was just walked on, did his part for about 10 minutes and got off. I mean, he had nothing to do with the show, but I believe it all went to his head. He really thinks he has some kind of power, and it's all an illusion. That's all I got to say.
Jose, I appreciate your call. Neil, what about it? Donald Trump, he touts himself as a great negotiator, the art of the deal. Is this about selling versus delivery? How should voters think about that? We know he's a strong pitch man. Jose's, you can't argue with that. He prides himself on pitching very well.
Yeah, and if you look, there's no doubt that part of the job of being president of the United States is about negotiation, and Donald Trump's negotiated a lot of real estate deals and restructured in bankruptcy processes, restructuring with creditors, that sort of thing. But negotiation is a small part of the job of being president. You also have to guide a policy process and decide look at the best evidence, decide what's the right answer. You have to be a crisis manager. You have to deal with all kinds of different complex policy issues over the course of a given day. It's a tough job, and the kind of level of detail we've seen from this campaign on all types of policy issues, including the economic stuff we're talking about today, is not very high. So I think the question is, if he gets elected, who is he going to surround himself with, who really does have that knowledge of detailed policy stuff, and is he once you're in the White House, you can't just kind of wave your hands and say, oh, this will all work out. You have to come up with legislation that you can get passed. And how he will do that, we really have no idea, because it's just not his personality. It's not his, what his team is experienced doing.
Marianne in Buffalo, New York. Marianne, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay, what do you see, Marianne?
Well, I see that Pence is going to be the person that's going to be the talking head of Trump business. He's going to be the one that is going to be leading. Trump is going to be listening to what Pence has to say. The House and Senate are going to be dealing with Trump, and he's going to defer to Pence for all of his answers. He's not going to be able to surround himself with good people. I don't really think anybody's going to want to really work with him.
Well,
I mean, they're distancing stuff from him now.
Marianne, you got a rough line, but let us pick it up. Jim, what about it? You get this into the Washington reality, and how do you see it unfolding if it were President Trump?
Well, I think that we know part of the way you can judge this is by looking at who he's surrounding himself with now. Oftentimes, presidential economic advisors and economic officials and administrations come from the team that was the campaign team that ran for president or from previous administrations of the same party. And in this case, I think what we see from Donald Trump is that he has surrounded himself with a lot of advisors who are from the business world. And we could end up then with a Treasury Secretary from the business world, which is not uncommon, with a head of the National Economic Council who's from the business world, which would be a little more rare. And I think we could see Trump taking advice from this inner circle of folks, many of whom have done business with him in the past, and then from himself and his vice president.
But where does it go from there? So they talk to each other, and then they turn to Washington, the machinery of Washington, and it responds? It just suddenly becomes a race car in their hands, or it's the same, you know, kind of, I don't know, Donald.
This is the question. The question is, what is Donald Trump's theory of change for Congress? And I believe that congressional Republicans, if he wins, would like to just send him a bunch of conservative bills that Paul Ryan and his caucus come up with and pass through the House and the Senate, and then he would sign them. I'm sure that a President Trump would have his own ideas about what the priorities would be, and there would be, as you put it, a negotiation. And I'm not sure anybody knows how he would deal with that. You know, we saw even with President Obama, who had been in the Senate, some real struggles with Congress throughout his two terms. And you know, Donald Trump has has no legislative experience. And so it would be an open question as to how he would be able to negotiate those sorts of details of legislation that you have to be committed to if you want to pass big bills.
Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'd just like to point out that when Hillary speaks of, you know, we're living off the work of past generations and we need to move forward with infrastructure and such, I'm just saying she's got nothing but a riddle. She's got nothing but a riddle. Here's the riddle, but where's the rhyme? Same way with Trump. He wants to drop taxes. That's the same old riddling thing. Where's the rhyme? How does that rhyme?
What does the rhyme mean to you, Bob? What do you mean by rhyme?
We need what does the new economy look like? What would be the substantive policy changes? We don't want the old Jim Crow society with a new tweaking.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want more James Crow.
Mm-hmm.
So what would the new society look like in terms of agriculture and the economy? Growing our own green economy? What are you talking about there? Get into that.
Bob, I appreciate your call. I mean, certainly... Neil, green economy does not describe what Donald Trump has in mind. He makes no pretense of that. He's embracing fossil fuels on the energy side like crazy. And part of what you throw out when you throw out regulations is environmental regulations. He said he would tear up the Paris Agreement. So green is not him. But what about on the Hillary side? Is she proposing something? If people are dissatisfied now, is she proposing change of a scale and grit that would actually change the trajectory of the U.S. economy, Neil? Or Mike?
The thing is, it's Hillary Clinton's approach to change is 5-point policy plans, finding a path forward, finding a way to get things through Congress. Hers is a much more realist's version of how you make change happen in Washington, how you change policy, how you change the trajectory of things. She's betting that you do enough of these things that you really do change the trajectory and you do get a world where, there's much better highway infrastructure, much better solar and wind power, all of these things that are part of her proposal. But I don't think she's not someone who speaks in these kind of world of like, I'll just fix everything. It's very much a, here are the 7 things I'm going to do or I'm going to propose or I'm going to try and get through the Senate that might make things better. And the question is this a moment when Americans are responsive to that kind of, incremental gradual process change as opposed to the kind of big hand-waving, vague on policy details that we get from Donald Trump?
And whether the big hand-waving could actually work. Mario in Austin, Texas. Mario, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call. The one thing that really concerns me with Trump is that I'm worried that we're going to end up in a trade war that we can't possibly win. His thoughts on China are that, let's bring jobs back to the United States. And, I've had a chance to travel in China, and I've been at Foxconn City with 350,000 employees. And those companies supply the entire world. It's not just the United States. And I've been in similar contract manufacturing companies here in Texas and in other places in the U.S. And they have 1,000, 2,000 employees. It's on a scale that I don't think most Americans could possibly imagine if they hadn't seen it. And, you know, as he's pandering to, you know, you talked earlier about the, you know, the union members that are really buying into what he's saying, but he's a real estate guy. He doesn't understand manufacturing. I mean, I hate to say it. I would love to see some of those jobs come back here, but by and large, that ship has sailed, and it's not sailing back this direction.
Mario, I appreciate your call. I got it. Jim, pie in the sky to imagine the, you know, flotilla full of jobs coming back to the USA from China with all that huge manufacturing infrastructure built up.
I think it would be difficult to imagine all those new, all those old jobs coming back. And our best hope for manufacturing is sort of a modest number of advanced manufacturing jobs being created here in the United States.
So, Melanie, I guess it brings me back to your labor contingent, because in the end, I mean, they need an economy that's strong. If it's not going to be jobs just coming back from China, Donald Trump says you would, but if that's easier to say than to do, who picks the lock here? Who changes the frustration level by actually changing thing on the ground?
Well, you know, I actually think in some cases at least, neither candidate really meets their ideal picture of what they want. And so, as I said earlier, I think some are viewing it as it's what's as good as it gets. And I think largely at this point, it's Hillary Clinton.
Because
the economy has improved under President Obama.
Yes, it has.
The unemployment rate has dropped. More jobs are being created. And she
last week again. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. She's very much talking about continuing that. She's given President Obama credit. She said she doesn't think he gets enough credit for what he's done. And a lot of what she's saying she's going to do, I think, would be a continuation of what he has done. And then she's also talking about, you know, policies like paid leave and, you know, closing the gender pay gap. Those are big buzzwords right now. Families are looking for those kind of benefits. And she has released plans. And I think there's a confidence in her because she's released plans. Now, as if Trump does the same in the coming weeks, maybe we'll see a shift in support.
Neil, just a couple of seconds here. Do you see Washington coming out of this election, no matter who wins, with a fire under it, that something significant has to change?
I hope so, because that's clearly where America is. And even if Hillary Clinton wins, people want to see something different from what they've been getting.
Neil Irwin, senior economic correspondent with the New York Times, at the Upshot there, author of The Alchemist. Neil, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Melanie Trotman at the Wall Street Journal covers labor there and economics, workplace. Melanie, always great to have you here.
Thank you.
And Jim Tankersley, economic policy reporter for the Washington Post. Jim, keep writing. We'll keep reading. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.